qué nivel de inglés ponerte en el currículo? Si estás pensando en hacer uno de los másters en inglés profesional de Vaughan, te invitamos a una prueba de nivel gratuita para que lo tengas mucho más claro. Y sin ningún tipo de compromiso, infórmate ya en el 911335833. Además, ahora fíñanciate hasta el 100% del coste y págalo cómodamente hasta en 24 meses. Puedes ver las condiciones de financiación en el apartado de máster en grupovaughan.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and on this program, well, this is a part of a series of programs in which I'm speaking about the Crusades, and in this case, the Third Crusade. And tonight, it's going to be about someone who was able to unite a very diverse numbers of people in order to, well, capture Jerusalem away from the Crusaders. His name is Yusuf ibn Ayyub, but history knows him better as Saladin. Now, Saladin in the West has an enviable reputation. For example, in Dante's Inferno, he's remembered along with Plato and Aristotle, believe it or not, Plato and Aristotle as being noble pagans, as being one of the people one of the people worthy of admiration. And all through the Middle Ages, and even subsequently, in the times until the 19th century, he was admired, absolutely admired, and remembered as being special, as being noble. Now, if we look at Yusuf ibn Ayyub, if we look at Saladin himself, if we look at him as he was, it doesn't seem like he would deserve this reputation. On the other hand, this is something common, something that we do all the time. For example, in Roman times, they talked about people who resisted. They talked about people like Viriatus, right? In Lusitania, Viriatus resisted the Romans. Viriatus was traicionado, was betrayed, and fell into the hands of the Romans. Betrayed by his own people, fell into the hands of the Romans, killed, and the whole resistance collapsed. But he was remembered as being great, as being noble, as being brave. Again, in Roman times, for example, when Tacitus was writing about the Germans, he made them sound enviable. He made them sound better, more virtuous than the Romans themselves. In other words, you have a tradition here of putting out the enemy as being better than you are, as being more worthy, again, digno, worthy of admiration than you. This is a tactic that is pretty constant in Western civilization. In the United States, you can see this with many of the writings about the American natives, about the Indians as the noble savage, as being better in practice at Christian values than the people who call themselves Christian. In other words, yes, if you have an opponent who is a better person than you are, it should tell you that you need to, we call it, to up your game, to improve what you're doing, to make a serious effort to be a better person. That's a long, long tradition that we have. And Saladin is very much a part of this tradition. You need an enemy you can admire. This is a constant in Western civilization. Choose an enemy and make him admirable, which in turn forces you to become better. All right. Let's talk about Yusuf ibn Ayyub. He was an outsider, a total outsider. He was Kurdish, and he grew up in the city of Aleppo. The city of Aleppo at that time was controlled by Turks. The Turks were moving in. They had come in from the Asian steppes. They had taken over Mesopotamia. They were in Anatolia. They were pretty much everywhere. The Turks and the other big power at the time were the Fatimids, this Shiite dynasty, this Shiite caliphate in their newly created city of Cairo, El Cairo, Cairo in Egypt, near the Nile. They had tried to demolish the pyramids to build that city, but it was much too difficult. The Fatimid city in Cairo. So you had these two worlds, which many times fought, but other times collaborated, and you did have perhaps. Precisely because he was Kurdish, his master was the Atabeg, serving Nur al-Din was his name, Nur al-Din, in Damascus. And at the same time, he had an uncle working in Cairo, with the Fatimids, an uncle who was very, very well connected. So yes, he had multiple masters from a relatively humble background, but he was smart, he was clever, he was a brilliant student, he was brave, he was good, he was going to be a soldier. His entire family were from a warrior caste. And so they recognized the talent in him and decided that the best place to polish him, the best place to bring out his good qualities, to convert him into an excellent soldier, that would naturally be Cairo. And so he went to Cairo, rising little by little within the ranks of the military there. So, a double outsider. First of all, he is a Kurd among the Arabs. Also, he is familiar with Syria, but of course not Egypt. Egypt is another thing entirely. Also, he is a Sunni, and Egypt is controlled by the Shiites. Very, very difficult to work under those circumstances. Every capacity, probability to suffer from prejudice, from rejection, from being an outsider. Being an outsider like that, you don't have the contacts you need. He did have his uncle. His uncle was working in the palace, and this was going to help him immeasurably. But everything else went to his disadvantage. His uncle, Shirku, worked for the vizier, worked for the, like a balido, worked for the person who actually did the job. You had the caliph and the person under him, like, I don't know, a prime minister who actually does the work of the government. Well, he was able to rise within the ranks in part because of his uncle, and in part because the king of Jerusalem, the Frankish king of Jerusalem, the Crusaders at this point had Jerusalem, had many enclaves around Jerusalem. They controlled the Principality of Jerusalem. They controlled many of the cities on the coast. They controlled Antioch further north. But they were relatively stupid. Well, at least this king, Almeric of Jerusalem, had a treaty, had a truce with Cairo, and he broke that treaty. He invaded Egypt, and this meant that the Turks and the Egyptians, the Shiites and the Sunnis, all had to work together against a common enemy. Now, during the war between Egypt and Jerusalem, Saladin's uncle was able to kill the vizier. He was able to assassinate the vizier and place himself in the position of being the new vizier, taking over. Now, that didn't last long. His uncle died shortly after, and the new appointee for vizier, believe it or not, the person they chose, a much younger man, the person chosen for vizier was Saladin. Now, he must have shown everybody that he was worth something at that point, because you don't get that kind of job unless you have a lot of talent, unless you know the right people. So, yes, he miraculously, he became the vizier. Now, Nur al-Din, remember his old master from when he was living in Aleppo, Nur al-Din of Damascus, told Saladin to take over, to kill the caliph, and to take over, take all the power for himself. And that would mean that Egypt would be under the control of Syria, and that all he needed to do was execute the right people, execute the caliph, it would have been an easy thing to do. However, Saladin did not listen to this advice and simply placed important people in important positions, people that were loyal to him. In other words, just working slowly, slowly but surely to consolidate his power base. And this, of course, was going to characterize him for the rest of his life. Slowly, slowly but surely, he builds his power. Nothing fancy, nothing flashy, nothing quick, nothing precipitous. No, slowly. And he could have easily killed the caliph, who himself was not very popular. Actually, it was risky because he himself could have been killed by the caliph. But they say he felt compassion. They say that the caliph at that time, Al-Adil, was young and perhaps manipulable, but in any case, Saladin decided to work behind the scenes, right? Entre bastidores. When you hold real power, it's always better not to be in the light of the public, right? It's always better to exercise that power from behind the scenes. Now, the caliph died a few years later, died of natural causes. He was not killed. He was not poisoned. It was definitely not something that Saladin had his hand in. And of course, nobody could blame him for conspiring or anything like that. No, his reputation was clean. However, he was able to take full control over Egypt, and at this point declares himself as Sultan. At this point, he works slowly and surely to end the Shiite domination of Egypt. Egypt is no longer Shiite territory. It becomes Sunni. Now, we don't know, or at least I don't know, whether this was done with violence, whether it was done, whether the Shiites felt that they had to abandon Egypt, or whether it was done, again, slowly and by consensus. But it, after so many years of being Shiite, it must have been very, very strange for that entire part of the world to be Sunni once again. Now, as Sultan, he worked closely with his ex-master in Damascus until that man died. And he was able to take control of Syria. He accepted Nur ad-Din's son as the supposed new leader, but that was actually only temporary. Now, Egypt and Syria, in other words, both sides the Kingdom of Jerusalem, both sides of the Kingdom of Jerusalem are controlled by Saladin, completely controlled by Saladin. Now, it was obviously going to be necessary to do something about the Crusaders, to try to retake that land. And Saladin, at this point, went into a public relations campaign, talking about how he was the leader of the faithful and how it was absolutely his job to eliminate these people, to get rid of these people, kick them out, expel them from the Levant. However, for the next decade or so, he didn't want any direct confrontation. He had numerical superiority. He had really everything he needed. He claimed that they were still very, very powerful, and that if there were a confrontation, possibly he would lose. However, It didn't convince people. In any case, in the meantime, he was able to extend his power along North Africa through to Libya into Mesopotamia, to modern-day Iraq, and down south through the Arabian Peninsula, all the way to Yemen. In other words, practically the known Islamic world, practically, an empire this big had not been seen in hundreds of years. So, he played the waiting game, and it was the Crusaders who began to get nervous. They were looking for a fight. And finally, they found one. In 1187, the confrontation came. And it was absolutely catastrophic. Very close to the Sea of Galilee, right? Lake Knesset, that area, Tiberias, the city of Tiberias, very close to that area, which of course has all kinds of biblical resonance and was a place of incredible pilgrimage. Even today, many, many people go just to be there, just to see what it's like. And there, of course, was an enormous Crusader castle, an impregnable castle, a castle that really couldn't be attacked, couldn't be put under siege, a castle that meant that anybody inside that castle controlled the entire area. Now, what did the Crusaders do when they learned that Saladin's army was nearby? They abandoned the castle and went looking for them. Many of these people not spent a lot of time in the Middle East. They had not spent a lot of time in dry countries. They didn't understand or appreciate the value of water. Especially in the north of Europe, water is something you have always. Before modern times, the nature of people living in the all the time, constantly wet. You couldn't escape the water. You could never dry out. Everything was always wet all the time, summer and winter. It rains. It's cold. It's everything gets wet. You can dry something out by the fire, but that's only temporary. It will be wet again very soon. Imagine spending your entire life wet. Well, that was how the people in Northern Europe lived until relatively recently. Now, these people did not understand dry and did not understand the need for water. And they left the protection of the castle and went looking for Saladin and evidently got lost, or they were out much longer than they anticipated and couldn't get back and didn't have enough water and started to suffer. And Saladin attacked and destroyed practically the entire army. This was the Battle of Hattin. It was it was the beginning of the end for the Crusaders, and it was all due to stupidity. It was all due to abandoning the castle there. In any case, yes. They had no water. Half supposedly died of thirst, simply for lack of water. And the ones who didn't die surrendered in a very humiliating way. Many of them were executed. Others were ransomed, but just a minimum. Most of the captives were sold into slavery. And this was an inauspicious beginning for the Knights Templar. The Knights Templar, Los Templarios, the Knights Templar were nominally in charge there. This was their grand defeat. Hatton, as I say, the beginning of the end. And Saladin consolidated as a great military leader. Okay, I have to take a break. I'll be back in just a minute with the second part of the program.
Decimos que estamos trabajando en equipo y realmente lo único que somos un grupo. Y la gran diferencia que existe entre un grupo y un equipo es el entusiasmo compartido. Cuando hay ilusión, cuando hay proyecto compartido, pues entonces somos un equipo porque tenemos una ilusión común que lleva a que en algunos momentos tengamos que prescindir de algunos intereses personales o de horarios o de otras ocupaciones porque realmente nos entusiasma aquello que estamos haciendo conjuntamente con otras personas.
¿Quieres descubrir las claves del éxito de la mano de Richard Vaughan y Javier Fernández Aguado? No te pierdas las dos nuevas convocatorias del seminario Emprender y Liderar. Las claves del éxito. Debido a la gran demanda y al éxito de las anteriores convocatorias, tienes dos nuevas oportunidades. El jueves 27 de septiembre o el jueves 25 de octubre de 16:30 a 20:30 horas en Áncora, Madrid, calle Trafalgar 6. Solicita más información en grupobaugan.com/seminario.
Every year, 200,000 new people enter the labor market looking for their first job. Are you one of them right now? Will you be one of them next year? How's your English? If it's not peachy keen, if it's not fine and dandy, if it's not top-notch, if it's not drop-dead stunning, then you have a problem, my friend, and you need to do something, and fast. Do you really expect to move up and to get ahead in this cutthroat world without English? Are you a starry-eyed dreamer or what? Come see us at Vaughan and let us show you what the Master in Inglés Profesional can do for you. Our MEEP. We'll set you up to impress. We'll groom you to shine. We'll place you at the starting line, ahead of all the rest. The Master in Professional English. Vaughan Systems. Come in and see us now.
¿Alguna vez has pensado en todo lo que puedes llegar a conseguir? Alcanzar todas tus metas, todas las oportunidades laborales al alcance de tu mano. EMEP, un programa en inglés para ejecutivos y profesionales de alto rendimiento a tiempo parcial durante 5 meses. Este es tu máster. Infórmate llamando al 91-133-5833. Y recuerda, también disponible en Valencia y Barcelona. Conoce más sobre el máster. Apúntate a la próxima sesión informativa en Madrid, Valencia y Barcelona. Además, ahora fíñate hasta el 100% del coste y págalo cómodamente hasta en 24 meses. Puedes ver las condiciones de financiación en el apartado de máster en grupobaugan.com.
La niñez es el momento en que hacemos preguntas incómodas. También es el momento perfecto para aprender inglés. Si no quieres que tus hijos se hagan mayores en saber inglés, olvídate de los viejos métodos que utilizaron contigo. Descubre Vaughan Junior, un método que despierta sus ganas de aprender y su curiosidad por el inglés. Aprenden de forma natural y divertida. Llámanos ahora al 91-133-5832.
was sitting in this coffee house, and this old man at the table next to me struck up a conversation.
He said you had an amazing story.
Aprende inglés con una colección de películas que hemos realizado con la colaboración de 20th Century Fox. Una serie de películas para que trabajes el inglés mientras te entretienes. Disfruta del inglés, del mejor cine, en tu delegación más cercana o en baugantienda.com. Ahora por compras superiores a 30 euros, envío gratis.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. On the first part of the program, I was speaking about Saladin. Actually, I was speaking about, well, the person he really was, not the person he has become, not the person who has come down to us in Sir Walter Scott, for example, being so special, so monumental. It was Nietzsche, the German philosopher, specialist in Greek language and literature, but German. Nietzsche wrote about history. Nietzsche wrote a book about the use and abuse of history. In this book, he talks about three kinds of history. The first kind is monumental history. In monumental history, you have the wonderful things that happened and the extraordinary people, the leaders, the idols, the people you admire, the people you want to know more about, the people who truly attract you, the great people in history. Now, this is monumental history, and it is really good because everybody needs a hero. Everybody needs a hero. And if you look back into history, you can find them. Great people. The abuse, however, comes to history itself. I mean, if you begin to look too closely, you'll see that not everybody is a hero 100% of the time. The fact is that if you want to monumentalize these people, if you want to use them as examples, if you want to project them big, like in the case of Saladin, then it doesn't help your understanding of history because you don't see things in context. And besides, somebody who did something enormously important in another country, in another century, that cannot be duplicated by us today. I mean, we would have to, we could do something great, but it would be completely different. You cannot use these people in the past, really, seriously, but you cannot use them as role models. You cannot benefit by emulating what they have done. It'll be completely different here and now. So yes, by thinking that you are acting like somebody great from history, you do damage to your own understanding of history. Okay, so this is the use and abuse of monumental history. And now that I'm started, I might as well talk about the other two. Analytic history. He talked about analytic history, the kind of things that maybe Marxist historians do, the kind of thing that the historians of the longue durée, historians who look very closely at not people, but tendencies, trends, statistics, property rights, the amount of cargo taken in maritime commerce, whether this increases or decreases, all of this. You have productive properties, technology, and how this affects history in the long run. This is very important for the underlying, right, subyacente, for the underlying trends and the large changes in the nature of human relations in history. And this can be exceptionally important. According to Nietzsche, it can be abused, because when you begin to think like this, you eliminate the human element from history. You eliminate the element of chance, right? Casualidad. You take that away from history. So that if you believe that two superpowers are going to come into confrontation inevitably because of their economies, their economic system, require them to fight, then you eliminate the human element. You don't talk about personalities. You don't talk about chance, fortuitous moments in history, elements that could have changed. No, you eliminate all of that. And so you have the use and you have the abuse of analytic history. And the third kind of history that Nietzsche mentioned, the third kind he calls antiquarian. Antiquarian history is quite often the history of a personal connection, things. So that if you buy antiques, right, antiguidades, if you buy objects that you can hold, if you walk into, I don't know, palaces or something like that, you feel the vibrations from the past. You feel yourself part of the past. It's like participating. It's like something, an object from the past is talking to you. You're having a conversation with history in places or with objects. And this can be wonderful because it gives you roots, right? Raíces. It can give you a sense of the exotic. It's one of the reasons that tourism exists. People want this kind of echo, historical echo. Now, that is the use, the abuse of this kind of antiquarian history can be in the fact that it is all the same. Something truly important, like, the Declaration of Independence of the United States. The Declaration of Independence, this venerable document, by the way, 7 years after it was written, they were calling it venerable, which means that there is an attempt to make it historical as quickly as possible. So yes, the venerable document, the Declaration of Independence of the United States, which is incredibly important. And next to it, you have the nail, el clavo, the nail from the table on which somebody signed that document. Okay, and which is more important? Well, if you really believe in antiquarian history, the nail, the document, they're both important. You can't really see the difference between them. It's very difficult to get a sense of historical perspective when what you're really looking for is this kind of sensual connection with the past. Any object is good enough. Yes. According to Nietzsche, these are the three ways of understanding history, the three uses, and the three abuses that all of us are susceptible to. And so, in the case of Saladin, he was projected, he was transformed into somebody operatic, somebody larger than life, somebody enormously special, incredibly generous, and noble warrior. And of course, you've got somebody equally larger than life, equally operatic in his nemesis. Well, actually, Saladin was the nemesis of Richard the Lionheart. And I'll be talking about him next week. But Richard the Lionheart, who came over and began to antagonize absolutely everyone. He had an ego that you cannot possibly imagine. And yes, Leopold of Austria, they fought. Oh, after the Battle of Acre, they fought. Leopold left. He left angry. And of course, when Richard came back from the crusade, Leopold made him pay. Leopold kidnapped him and held him for un rescate, a ransom that was worth something like three times as much as the entire revenue, royal revenue, of England. So that it took years. It took years and years. Well, it took a generation to pay off that rescate. And so Richard suffered for this misunderstanding with Leopold. He also antagonized Philip II of France, who Philip August, and who of course was trying to encourage Richard's brother John to usurp the throne in his absence. So that while Richard was participating in the crusade, his throne, at least in England, was not safe at any moment. Anyway, we get this in Robin Hood, by the way. The whole story of Robin Hood has this as background information. Meanwhile, Saladin. Now, just before the break, I was talking about the Battle of Hattin, which pretty much decided the fate, right? El destino. Pretty much decided the fate of Jerusalem. And it was only then, it was only when the Crusader armies were wiped out because of their own stupidity. Not because of anything Saladin had done, but because of their own stupidity and perhaps unfamiliarity with the local conditions, the local terrain. But yes, this was all on the Knights Templars, the Los Templarios. It was all their fault because nominally, at least, they were in control. They should have known better. In any case, Richard did come, and Richard was very impetuous, and he was an excellent general, an excellent strategist. I'm going to talk about him next week. But let's just say that he was very much like Hannibal when Hannibal was in the Italian peninsula, making life difficult for the Romans. Everybody was afraid of Hannibal. And you had this general, Fabius, an older man, only in the position because all of the good families had been eliminated in battles with Hannibal. Hannibal had killed everybody, practically everybody of note in the Roman army. And so you've got Fabius there, and Fabius limits himself to making life difficult for Hannibal. Hannibal is in a hurry. Fabius has all the time in the world. In the Roman Senate, nobody liked Fabius. He was called cunctator. He was called the delayer. El que va con retraso, el lentito. He was called the cunctator, and his strategy worked. Well, in this case, you have a Fabian strategy. Saladin is not in a hurry, has never been in a hurry. He's going to found his own dynasty, the Ayyubids, and they are going to pretty much control that area for the next half century or so. So yes, enormously successful and not in a hurry, whereas Richard is in a hurry. Richard's kingdom is in danger. Actually, Richard's kingdom, the whole Angevin territory, very delicate, and it's going to implode in a very short time. Richard doesn't know this, but he has to get in and get out quickly. And of course, he never did recover Jerusalem. He gave it up for lost. He had to go home. And there, who was waiting for him? Leopold of Austria. Yes, a disaster. And a very lucky thing for Saladin, who, as I say, from being an outsider, very much an outsider, he became the most powerful man in that part of the world. The most powerful man there had been for centuries. Perhaps because of his outsider status. In Arab historiography, for centuries afterwards, they really didn't talk about him. They didn't mention him. It wasn't really until the 19th century, when, as I say, his legend was still strong in the West, it wasn't really until the 19th century that the Crusades, or Saladin's resistance to the Crusades, became important again. With imperialism and with a European conquest of most of the world, people began to talk about the Crusades again and began to talk about Saladin again. Because, as I say, in that part of the world, perhaps because he was a Kurd, perhaps because of his role in transforming that empire, the Fatimids, from Shiite to Sunni. But yes, largely forgotten. Now, I'm going to talk about one of the people who was absolutely remarkable of that time. One of the people who may have been forgotten, at least by us. Crowned king of Jerusalem at the age of 13. This was 75 years. This is to 75 years to the day. It was the anniversary of the founding of the Latin kingdom, of the Crusader Latin kingdom. 75 years later, he is king at age 13. And Jerusalem, as you imagine, the center of the world. In the Middle Ages, all the maps put the center of the world, all the mappa mundi, right? All of the world maps had Jerusalem as the center of the world, because it was, undoubtedly. No, nobody could question that. and here he was, king of the center of the world, at age 13. Now, he was the second child of that that same prince, Almeric, who had been so stupid as to invade Egypt in the first place, putting Saladin where he was. He was the second child, and all the other heirs died without any descendants, leaving him as the only candidate for queen. He and his sister, Sibylla, this was Baldwin and Sibylla, these two exceptionally young heirs to the throne. Now, his father, as I say, died from dysentery. He had been attacking Damascus. He had been attacking Nur al-Din, that's Saladin's patron, Saladin's master, the Atabeg, in Damascus. And while he came back, he died of dysentery. He was a very bright boy, very apt, and it was just a question of when he was going to be ready to fully take over. There was a regent put in power, and, well, at age 15, he took over. At age 15, he was a warrior already. He was beginning to fight. However, at age 15, they noticed that he had no sensation in his arm, his right arm. You could pinch it, you could bite it, you could do anything to his right arm, and he wouldn't feel a thing. Now, some of the best doctors in the entire Middle East were called in to make a diagnosis, and they were very, very worried that this might become leprosy. But of course, it was much too early to make that diagnosis. However, they were worried, very, very worried. Now, the strategy there was to cooperate very closely with the Byzantines. Nobody could risk becoming an enemy of the Byzantines. So they worked really closely with the Byzantines. But you know who else worked closely with the Byzantines? Was Saladin. Saladin made a treaty with the Byzantines. That meant that crusaders coming to Byzantium, they were told not to bother. They were told that Byzantium was not in a state of war or aggression. So, and of course, this was yet another source of friction between Byzantium and the Frankish kingdoms. Well, you're going to see that, well, in the Fourth Crusade, the enemy becomes Constantinople. In the Fourth Crusade, the Crusaders attack and destroy Constantinople. But this kind of bad blood, this kind of misunderstanding, begins now. So, Saladin, after Hattin, Saladin understood that Jerusalem was practically defenseless. And Baldwin wanted to meet him at his own ground, first in the Templar castles, the enclaves on the coast. Well, he went down to Ascalon, and Ascalon, there, well, he was in the worst position possible because he was outnumbered. He was in a castle. Saladin simply ignored him. Simply ignored him. They ignored the Templar castle in Gaza. They ignored the Templar castle in Ascalon with the king in it. And they just went toward Jerusalem. But of course, this 15-year-old boy leads his knights out and begins to attack Saladin's forces from behind. And he's enormously successful in that. With 367 knights, they cause lots and lots of problems for Saladin. So, there was a complete victory. The victory at Montgasard, and this boy Baldwin came out of it a hero. But of course, also with total, complete leprosy. All right, I have to finish this now, but I will continue on my program tomorrow.
Descubre, aprende. Esto es Vaughan Radio. La radio que te entretiene, te acompaña, la radio que te enseña. Esto, lo que escuchas, es Vaughan Radio Madrid, 100.4 FM.
Okay, Luis, let's begin your level test. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right, here we go. Where will you be tomorrow at this time?
Tomorrow I will be in class.
Repeat it.
Tomorrow I will be in class.
Tomorrow I'll be in class. I'll be in class. Very good.
En poco más de media hora y de forma totalmente gratuita, este alumno sabrá exactamente cuál es su nivel de inglés. ¿Y tú? ¿Todavía no sabes qué nivel de inglés ponerte en el currículo? Si estás pensando en hacer uno de los másters en inglés profesional de Vaughan, te invitamos a una prueba de nivel gratuita para que lo tengas mucho más claro. Y sin ningún tipo de compromiso.